Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. Days after the terrorist attack on 9/11 at the World Trade Center, it was announced that the search for survivors was over and the task of focusing on the finding remains would begin. A promise was made by the Office of the Chief Medical Examiner that whatever it took to identify the source of every single human remain recovered from the World Trade Center site would, no matter how small, they would make that effort to identify that fragment of a human being. That was a huge pledge, but perhaps it was bigger than could actually be accomplished, but it was what many of the family members of the victims needed to hear at the time. There were 2,753 people killed at the Ground Zero on 9/11. 293 of the bodies were found intact. 21,900 body fragments were found in the debris. 1,113 people are still unidentified from this ordeal. So this is all being written about in the new book, Who Owns the Dead? The Science and Politics of Death at Ground Zero. The author is J.D. Aronson, professor of science and technology and society and the director of the Center for Human Rights Science at Carnegie Mellon University. And Jay, this is a tough topic. I mean, you are writing about a very sensitive issue here.
Yes, it definitely is a very sensitive issue.
And your approach, I mean, you're trying to acknowledge all of the sensitivity and all of the hurt and the grief of the victims and the people who watched this terrible event and people who had loved ones there, friends and family, and then also the science behind the DNA and this practicality of this the world's largest crime scene ever. And then this promise of identifying even the smallest fragment of human being. So there's a lot there.
What was interesting was that my starting point was actually what you just described, the scientific effort to recover and identify the missing. What I found when I actually got into the story was the ethical and the political and the cultural and the moral questions were in many ways as weighty or sometimes even more difficult to resolve than the scientific issues. And so that was one of the big findings of the work that I did, was that the politics matters just as much as the science. And that's something that we don't often think about when we engage in forensic recovery and identification, or when policymakers are trying to figure out how they're going to deal with this in the future.
I've always been fascinated by Fresh Kills, the waste disposal site, Staten Island, where the remains of 9/11 ended up, and then the massive effort that they had to sort through the remains and put them in categories and classifications and try to identify and find human remains. But people were pulverized. They were vaporized. There was nothing left of them. And Fresh Kills, people say, and when they decided we're going to put the debris in Fresh Kills, people were horrified by the name and they wanted the name changed.
Yeah, so from a practical perspective, bringing the remains, the debris from the site to Fresh Kills was a very good idea. This was a site that had had been a garbage dump, a landfill, for several decades, and it was a lot of open space. There weren't people who were going to be snooping around. It wouldn't be work that would bother, residents or a population.
Right. So they had just closed Fresh Kills.
Yeah, they had just closed the site a few months ago, and they were sort of in the process of figuring out what to do next.
And can you explain the name?
Fresh Kills means I believe it means river or stream
in Dutch,
and so it's one of these ironic things that the name doesn't mean what it actually sounds like in English. When you think of a 110 story buildings getting crushed into basically 11 stories, human beings being mixed in with office debris and the concrete and the steel
and plane parts.
Don't forget, there were lots of plane parts, and there were also lots of restaurants in the towers and lots of food service there. So you also have a lot of food remains, like, meat and other things. When you think about the task of having to find the human remains, and also the guns and money and contraband material from the various federal agencies that had offices there. That was something that we don't always talk about, that there was a lot of material that was held by various federal agencies in vaults or in, you know, in their offices that also needed to be recovered. But, you know, doing it on site isn't really a great option. But then when you think of bringing it to a place called Fresh Kills, that's, you know, from a kind of emotional point of view for families, that's a very difficult thing to stomach. And so, you know, I think that the idea that the remains were being sorted out on a landfill was something that angered families, but the name just sort of added salt on the wounds, I think.
The DNA, the collecting, and then this trying to find matching samples, the errors in collecting, talk about that.
So when I talk to people with a scientific background, they tend to get very excited about the, you know, some sort of new technology emerging around around this investigation. The most important things that really happened when you think about the scientific developments were first and foremost the statistical developments. So you think of how difficult it is to take a very damaged and degraded small piece of a human being that has been through fire and through water, which are heat and water are the two best ways of destroying DNA. So and time, of course. But when you think of these remains, it's very difficult to get usable DNA out of them. So there were innovations in the extraction of DNA from the remains. Then you have to develop a DNA profile. And often what you're getting is a partial profile because so much of the DNA sequence has been destroyed. So you might say there are 13 places within the genome that you're looking for a particular set of or a particular stretch of nucleotides, or, you know, the letters that make up.
We've had plane crashes before. We've identified people. We had Oklahoma City. We've had mass casualties before.
Yes, we have, but nobody made a promise to identify each and every remain. I think that's the key here is that the medical examiner promised not to identify a remain from every person to confirm that they were there, which was the standard way of doing a plane crash or some other sort of accident or even a disaster where you knew who was there, and your goal as a forensic scientist wasn't to identify every remain. It was to confirm the presence of a particular person so that a death certificate could be issued or that part of the body could be returned to the family. But there was never a sense that they would return every single remain ever before. I think that's the new thing that happened here. And it was because this tragedy wasn't just a tragedy, it was also a national event. I mean, when we think about history in the 20th century, we think about, or, you know, in recent history, we think about before 9/11 and after. In 100 years, if we still think that same way, you know, I have no idea. Our understanding of what's historic tends to change over time. I think it still will be a very important moment in history. But this was something that Americans had never seen before. They had never experienced an attack like this, at least, you know, in the post-Civil War
era. And we're still experiencing it today, still processing it as we move forward. And we've revisited every September 11th. Trying to learn more about what happened and who we are as a nation. Who Owns the Dead is the name of the book. We're going to continue our conversation with the author, J.D. Aronson, when we come back from the break. The phone line is 210-614-8980. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. 9/11 created the world's largest crime scene at Ground Zero. The hunt to find and identify the human remains at the World Trade Center became a task that was matched in size only by the enormity of the grief of the victims' families. Dealing with the human remains and personal property at the World Trade Center tested the sensitivity of our culture. Our instinct is to carefully bury and honor our dead. How was this accomplished? This is covered in the new book, Who Owns the Dead? The Science and Politics of Death at the Ground Zero. The author is J.D. Aronson. So how did you come up with this title, Who Owns the Dead? Why ownership? Why is that important?
So there are a couple of things. I think one of the issues that we deal with in this story is the political value of the victims. And so I think you have, in the aftermath of 9/11, you have various politicians invoking the victims of the attacks in their efforts to, you know, go to war or determine who is to blame for this. You hear the victims being invoked many times. And so there were also family members who pushed back on that, and they said, no, we don't want our family members to be used in that political way. Others said, we want you to go get vengeance for our loved ones who died so senselessly. And so there was a sense of both within the families and between the political world and the sort of private world about who had the right to mourn these dead and what was their meaning in the bigger picture. You also had a question about the remains. Where would the remains of the unclaimed and unidentified victims be interred for perpetuity? There were some who wanted to have these remains buried on site at Ground Zero, you know, at the World Trade Center, in some particular some kind of, you know, grave or tomb when whatever memorial would happen was created. And they envisioned either an above ground memorial or something that was sort of dignified and sacred. What ended up happening through a long process that I can't get into now, but that I detail in my book, is that the remains ended up in a repository behind a wall of the museum. And in order to visit that wall, unless you're a family member, you have to pay $24. You have to pay the entry fee. And so there's a question of who gets to decide what happens to the remains. When the decision was made to inter the remains in this way behind this wall, that as a part of the museum, whether the remains are part of the museum or not is a dispute. But once this decision was made, some families said, listen, we don't want our family members to be in a paid museum that's controlled by a private foundation. We would rather have the remains taken and buried either maybe somewhere in New Jersey or, you know, at a site in New Jersey or at Arlington National Cemetery. And so this double meaning of ownership is not only about who owns the memory, but also who has the right to control what happens to the actual physical remains that can't be returned to a family.
So the organization, World Trade Center Families for a Proper Burial, they were very vocal about this museum, and the headlines were mm-hmm. saying, don't turn our dead family members into a revenue stream.
Yeah.
But they complained bitterly about neglect and mismanagement. Yes. They thought that that the victims were not being properly thought of. And you had a lot of cultural differences. And we had Muslims, we had people of the Jewish faith, we had people who were undocumented immigrants who were working in the hotels and in the mm-hmm. restaurants, and very hard to trace who those people were. Yeah. So there was a lot going on there.
Yeah, and what's interesting is the reason that I ended up writing the book, as opposed to just doing a couple of articles or looking at particular parts of the story, was I just couldn't understand the reaction that this group of families had to the decision to store remains in fresh kills, and then the debate about where the remains would be interred, the ones that were unidentified or unclaimed. And I just it just seemed irrational to me or illogical that these families were so critical of the decision.
But they're dealing with an enormous amount of grief.
Yeah, but what's interesting is when you really look at their arguments, it's that they felt like the people making the decisions didn't listen to families in general. They felt that there was a small group of handpicked family members who were speaking on behalf of the larger population of families. And so I don't think that any of them individually would say, we want you to listen to me, or we want you to listen to the 10 of us, or the 20 of us, or the 100 of us, or maybe even the 500 of us, depending on how you decide who they were speaking for. They fundamentally believed, you know, rightly in some cases, and probably not so rightly in others, that the decisions were being made without family input, without the input of the entire family population. And so their argument wasn't that nobody was listening to them or their particular grief mattered more than other family members' grief. It was that these decisions should not be made by a group of highly paid either foundation staff or politicians. Decisions about the remains should be made by the families. And so this feeling that the city didn't care about them, that city officials, city representatives didn't care about them, came about because there were, at so many points, there either was or seemed to be a kind of insensitivity to the grief of families writ large. Now, again, not to this particular group of families. They didn't feel like they were speaking for themselves. They felt like they were trying to get the decision makers to actually ask in a democratic way the population of family members. And so, you know, we tend to write off their actions as, you know, grief or irrational, and that's kind of the position that I started with. But I realized that when you actually look at the decisions that were made over the course of the, you know, 10 years or so until the point where the decision was made to inter the remains within the museum, there were so many places where, whether, you know, really or, you know, or apparently, it seemed like that there were decisions being made in which families were being asked what they thought, but they weren't being listened to. And I think that was the thing that really upset this group of families who went on to sue the city.
J.D. Anderson, Aronson is the author of the book, Who Owns the Dead? The Science and Politics of Death at Ground Zero. Our phone line is 210-614-8980. Have you been to the 9/11 memorial? Did you feel like it was morbid, or was it holy ground, somewhere in between? Give us a call, 210-614-8980. And so back to Fresh Kills, and because that site was where so many of the remains went through, and these were vaporized, pulverized. There's just dust. The finest remains from anything was it was kind of milled into the soil and buried at the site. So I mean, when we see the statistics, over 1,000 people from the Ground Zero were never identified, and they never found any remains for. They're probably in the dirt at Fresh Kills.
Well, I mean, I think that it goes without saying that in conditions like this, there is undoubtedly something that one would consider a human remain within that fine material. I don't think anyone disputes that. The question is, does that possibility make that site or that soil sacred? You know, if we know that there is some human, you know, DNA or some very small bits of bone or something like that, does that create a situation where we have to treat that that material as something that's sacred? Or can we leave it at Fresh Kills in, you know, in some sort of dignified manner, separated at least in theory from the garbage below it? Or does the fact that this is a former landfill mean that we have to move that material to somewhere else? I don't think that there are, like, you know, big, large bones or large fragments of human muscle tissue, whatever else you can think of. But there's undoubtedly some, you know, there's a kind of physical essence of the victims, and we can't really quantify that because these are remains from which you can't extract DNA, or that they're just too small to run them through the process that you would need to extract DNA.
But it's all connected to the emotional core of the Ground Zero.
Yes, but I think it's not just the emotional core. It's that there was a feeling among certain family members who were following this that the people making decisions didn't listen to them or didn't care about their needs, and not just their needs, the needs of the families. I'm not sure how much I agree with that. You know, I didn't make judgments in the book. It was very important for me not to judge the views of various family groups, both, you know, the ones who were on the side of the city and the ones who fought against the work that they were doing. It wasn't my job to make judgment claims.
Sure. Okay, let's go to the phone lines. Elaine has called in. Elaine, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Thank you. I just have a comment. I went to the 9/11 memorial 3 years ago, and I thought that the tribute that they had to them and, you know, the whole area there was very solemn and very, very tastefully done, and it touched me essentially to my core. And I hope that the surviving members of the families, the people that were lost, you know, I hope they can come to that as well, because it touched the nation as well.
Elaine, thank you for your call. I'm short on time. I'm going to go straight to Pete. Hi, Pete. Welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
I wanted to know, what did they end up doing with the remains, and what ended up happening with them?
Okay, Pete, thank you for the call. So, Jay?
It's a great question. So if you go to the memorial and museum, you descend to the ground level, you know, seven stories down, and you go through the museum. This is not part of the memorial.
But some people were able to have burials.
Oh yeah. So when remains were identified and families wanted to actually get the remains back, then those remains were handed over to the families in a very dignified way.
And sometimes it would just be like a credit card or something like that. It was not even a human remain, just an artifact of that individual.
There were occasions where personal effects were handed back. But when there was a remain that was identified, and this happened a lot, and remember, many of the bodies were found in a lot of pieces, in a lot of smaller pieces, some bigger, some smaller. So through a funeral home, the remains would be handed over to the families, and the families could do what they wanted. After you would receive a remain, when you first received a remain, you would receive a form from the medical examiner's office that if more remains were identified, what should they do with them? You could either say, notify me every time, notify me at a certain point, or I don't want any more. Don't tell me if you find other remains. I have enough, or I just can't deal with that idea.
All right. J.D. Aronson is the author of Who Owns the Dead. I thought that your book was writing into the future, getting us ready for the next big catastrophe. I hope not, Jay, but thank you so much for your book. And this is The Source on Texas Public Radio.